Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Big doings are underway to improve the arch grounds on the St. Louis Riverfront, and update a little bit later in this program. But first, a chance to chat with one of NPR's best-known correspondent hosts, David Greene. You hear him often these days on Morning Edition. He's remembered for covering the White House, politics, the Arab Spring, and also as NPR's Moscow correspondent. He's in town for an event we'll be telling you about a little bit later, and he is spending some time with us. David, it's nice to see you. Thanks
Don,
so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I was surprised to learn just a moment ago that you're no stranger to St. Louis, that you interned at the Post-Dispatch at one point.
I did. It was really my entry into working in journalism in Washington. I was a junior in college, and I desperately wanted a newspaper internship in Washington, and was rejected by every single summer internship that I applied for. And there was a program called the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism. They had programs in the fall and the spring, and I knew they had a relationship with the Post-Dispatch, but they didn't really have an established summer program. So I called the bureau chief, John Sawyer, and I just said, is there any way that you could get funding from this program and I could work for you this summer? And, you know, a couple weeks later, I was there, and I just learned a lot about newspaper, a lot about covering politics, and just a great group of journalists in that newsroom taught me so much.
It must have served you well because you went on to the Baltimore Sun. I worked in Baltimore for 6 or 7 years myself.
Oh, really?
So there
you go.
We have that in common.
Yeah.
So you were there for 6 or 7 years yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about the newspaper business, what are your thoughts about what's going on in that world today?
It's an incredibly difficult environment, and you know the Sun was a paper that I owe so much to. When I came there, John Carroll and Bill Marimo, who in the newspaper world are two very big names, were the editor and managing editor of that paper, and they brought in young people, and if you were willing to do anything, you know, cover the biggest story, the smallest story. I covered a school board in a rural county in Maryland for a couple years and learned journalism the way it should be taught. And it was just this great sort of environment to become sort of get to know the world of journalism and newspapers. And I think the more newspapers struggle, the more I worry that you know, sort of apprenticeship goes away. And it's, you know, it's sad. I mean, there's still great papers. There's still a lot of great newspaper journalists. But I, you know, my time in Moscow, as you said, I was there for a couple years for NPR. There was a building that we lived in that where the NPR apartment and the NPR bureau is located. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this building was all news organizations. You know, every newspaper you could imagine, including the Baltimore Sun, had their bureaus there. And a lot of those places have closed down. So now it's just one sort of microcosm. You could feel it. There were Russian businesses moving in, that they were becoming our neighbors. And, you know, it was tough because we were there, the New York Times, but you started to get this eerie feeling that you were, you know, sort of the only game in town because newspapers just couldn't afford to be there anymore.
I don't think there's anybody that has more foreign bureaus than NPR right now.
We are really, really proud of that. And, mm-hmm. and that the commitment that our news department and news division and network has made to maintain that is just really impressive, because a lot of the stories that we cover and that I covered in Moscow, they're not the stories that are going to, you know, grab headlines. They're not the stories that are flashy, but we know how important they are. And you know, it's from everything I hear from our top editors, you know, we're not – nothing is going to change. I mean, we remain committed to that presence. And I just am in awe of a lot of my colleagues who – especially those who cover wars. I mean, Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and some of the names, Kelly McEvers and Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, and people who have spent, you know, months on end just in war zones. You know, I really live in awe of them.
You know, it's interesting, and most of them are women, and that is so much different than what has typically and traditionally been and historically been the case in the news business. Wonderful, wonderful reporters, and they're in the hottest spots in the world right now.
They are really impressive, and some of their reporting is some of the most memorable that you know, Lourdes Garcia Navarro. I mean, it just the names, Julie McCarthy. It's really just impressive colleagues, and it's an honor to be in the same organization with them.
They are outstanding. Do you ever wish, most recently perhaps, that you were back in Moscow right now, given what's going on with Mr. Snowden and Mr. Putin?
It's hard, Don, because I love hosting and I love being in the studio, and I think it's a special kind of relationship that you have when you're sort of in a host chair, taking listeners and an audience through the day's news, whether it's difficult, sensitive, sad, funny, you know, you're kind of laughing and reacting, you're curious along with listeners. I love it. But are there days when I sort of miss having the freedom to be out there and wake up in the morning in Moscow and say, so, you know, what am I going to go to Central Asia and cover a story about ethnic conflict in Kyrgyzstan today? Am I going to go to Siberia? You know, that's really liberating. And if you're a reporter, you know, it's hard to say there's a better job than being out there as a foreign correspondent.
What's your take on what Putin is doing with this whole Snowden thing?
It's hard to say. I mean, Putin, he's an incredibly difficult politician and leader to totally figure out. You know, he is someone who manages his relationship with the West in a very careful way. You know, since the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia has been a country that in some ways can be insecure and can look for ways to feel mighty and important. And I think Putin has you know, seen his popularity and his support begin to drop away, and which I think is concerning him. We've seen some really questionable policy decisions. Some of the laws that are considered very anti-gay around the world are a real disappointment to many Russian observers. A lot of critics of Putin feel like he's taken the country backwards when it comes to respecting human rights. There was a horrific scene where some nationalists attacked people of ethnically from the Caucasus at a market recently outside Moscow, and the police responded not largely by going after migrants who were ethnic minorities, and that says something about, you know, raises a lot of questions whether Putin is trying to whip up, you know, ethnic nationalism in the country to maintain support. So it's very difficult, and there are a lot of questions about democracy in that country. But I'll tell you, I'm actually working on a book right now. I went back and took the Trans-Siberian Railroad in February across the whole country for my second time, and it is such a warm and poetic place, and so nuanced. The whole narrative that I felt and as a kid, kind of, well, the Soviet Union has collapsed, and when is Russia going to be a democracy like the United States? You just realize how much more complicated it is, and these are people who have a very tragic past, and it's difficult to get into the Russian soul and the Russian mindset.
I was just going to say, the last 100 years in Russia, what an awful century this has been, going back to the Revolution and World War I and all the rest of it, of course.
Yeah, and you talk to a lot of Russians, and they look at the Arab Spring, and they basically say, we want no part of that. I mean, we have had our history of revolution and upheaval. And so even people who say, you know, we don't feel like we have a government that cares for us and cares for our communities, we don't necessarily like Vladimir Putin, there's a real fear of change. And it's a fear that once you learn more and more about what Russians have been through, it makes sense.
How do they feel about us, the average man on the street, woman on the street in Russia?
I did some interviews with Russians, especially when the space shuttle program ended, and we were going to be U.S. astronauts were going to be relying on the Russian Soyuz capsules to take astronauts get our astronauts up to space. And you know, it's a real sense of there's an interesting nostalgia for Soviet times. There are a lot of Russians who feel less important on the world stage and not all that respected. And that's a really prevailing feeling. And you know, I've talked to people and said, you know, you have this history of, you know, your cosmonauts were, you know, incredibly famous, and you know, there was a time when Americans sort of felt like we were being beaten by Soviet science ingenuity, and your cosmonauts were beating us to space. And they said, yeah, that was a different time, and that was a time that made us really proud. But what becomes complicated is when Russians their Soviet nostalgia starts to get into Stalinism. And I think, you know, as Russians sort of deal with Stalin and so much cruelty, you know, a lot of them have trouble because they think about, you know, God, that was a time when the Soviet Union was so powerful and so important, and we need that kind of order. But what we don't want is the repressions. And I've done a lot of interviews with people who've said what we really need today is, you know, someone like Stalin who will set this country straight, so we don't have the economic inequality that we have today. So the government takes care of its people, but we don't want the repressions. We don't want the cruelty. And I don't know if that's a balance that Russia can necessarily find.
Well, as they say, only time will tell.
Only time will tell, indeed.
There's so much going on. I want to bring it back to this country because I mentioned Snowden and, of course, what's going on in Washington now that you're dealing with some of that fallout with the NSA business. You know, I was looking over the list of all the things that have been going on with regard to the NSA, the rollout of health care. We've got the sequestration. We've got the debt ceiling. We've got budget things ahead of us. We've got the polarization in Washington. For a guy like you, it must be good to get out of town once in a while.
It is. I love Washington. I love working there. I was honored to cover the White House. I don't want to live anywhere else. My wife is opening a restaurant soon. We've signed a 10-year lease on a building. So we're in Washington, and I'm really happy to be there. But I'm from Pittsburgh. My wife is from Ohio, and we love nothing more than to get away and get out of the Washington mindset whenever we possibly can. So, yeah, I'm smiling being in St. Louis for a reason.
Well, I know you're a big sports fan. Should I apologize now for the Cardinals having done what they did to your Pirates?
I would appreciate the apology. That'd be nice.
It may be payback time in Boston, though, for us.
I don't know. You've got Walker in Game 6. Watching the Pirates go against him. I brought this for you. Someone gave this to me last night from the station at an event I got in trouble. I violated a golden rule. As I was arriving in St. Louis, I sent a tweet because I had met a Red Sox fan in the airport in Pittsburgh, and I told him that I hoped that they beat the Cardinals tonight. Okay. And he actually looked at me and said, "Oh, are you a Cubs fan or a Pirates fan?" And I said, "I'm a Pirates fan," but I think that tweet got me this gift. So it's a homemade Cardinal that I had on my sport coat last night. So.
Put it next to your heart.
I will see what happens.
David Greene is our guest. He's from NPR. You all know him, of course. You hear him just about every day on this radio station, St. Louis Public Radio. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment, and we'd like you to be a part of it with the time that's left with Mr. Greene. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us a tweet if you'd like to at STL on air or email talk@stlpublicradio.org. Back with David Greene in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with David Greene of NPR. He is in town for an event this evening that is going to be at St. Louis University. David, what is that all about?
It's an event that we're putting on with my colleague Robert Smith. And I'll take you back to about a year ago, Don. At Morning Edition, we did a series called Family Matters. We followed three families, and we were looking at this trend that we had caught in the country. Different adult generations, multiple generations, were all living under a single roof at an incredibly higher rate than in 10, 20, 30 years ago in the United States. And there were two real trends that were going on. One was the tough economy. So you had, 20-somethings, 21, 22-year-olds still living with their parents. You also had elderly people who aging longer. So their families were dealing with, if they didn't want to turn to a nursing home, they were having their mothers, fathers living under the same roof. So you had generations who were sort of in this squeeze together.
That's the way it used to be, however.
It's the way it used to be. It's the way a lot of other countries.
Sure.
It's pretty common. But in the United States, that trend kind of dipped and was coming back. So we just followed three families, and it was really a window into the types of sacrifices that families are making in this economy. It was just a window into life in this country right now. And so tonight, my colleague Robert Smith from our Planet Money team and I, we have a panel of a few guests who are experts in financial planning and sort of economic thinking. And it's really just going to be a conversation. Robert and I have talked about hoping that the audience will come and just want to almost become an NPR story, sort of part of an NPR story, and just listen to their stories and hear what people are talking about. We're going to talk about, housing, planning for retirement, college costs. It's just going to be a great discussion and conversation.
That's at 6:30 tonight at room 409 in DeBerg Hall over at St. Louis University. And folks can get more information on our website. I understand it's free, but people should go to our website to make arrangements to be there.
Yeah, and I think the seating might be limited, so it's worth getting on and making sure. So we hope to see everyone there.
6:30 tonight, room 409 in DeBerg Hall. Before I go to the phones, we have a number of people who want to talk to you, David. I just want to get some sense of what you may be seeing in Washington these days. I alluded to all the things that are hot right now. But one of the things I think a lot of people in the middle of the country are wondering about is this polarization, the lack of civility. Do you see anything happening right now that is likely to change the tempo that we've been seeing for the last couple of years?
You know, that's the frightening thing. I think the answer is no. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the redistricting and a lot of the political realities today they mean that a lot of these members have absolutely no incentive to change the stances that they have taken in the recent debates. So unless you have, you know, members of both parties deciding to really do something completely different and take a risk. And it might happen. I mean, some of my colleagues who cover Capitol Hill say sometimes you see good things in the absolute darkest of moments. So we'll see. But this seems to have gone to, you know, another level. I mean, there are people, including Lawrence Summers, I mean, the former president of Harvard University and advisor to President Obama, has written about how gridlock can be a good thing. I mean, this country was sort of designed to have local and state governments sort of more responsive to the needs of people. And if Washington is not making policy, that doesn't always mean it's a bad thing. There's some of you that Washington, an inactive Washington, is better. But the partisanship right now, you know, just seems to have gone to a whole new level and crossed into a new place that a lot of people are worried about.
I wonder how much the administration is being hurt by this whole NSA thing right now. I mean, not only domestically, but internationally.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, the revelations about Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, and you know, the amount that her cell phone might have been tapped, I think that's presenting some real tough questions for this administration. You know, we'll have to see where it goes. And we'll have to see, you know, on Capitol Hill if Republicans really, you know, try to use that.
We have a questioner calling from his car phone. Jim, why don't you join us now and talk with David Green? Go ahead.
Hi, Jim.
Yes, David. Hi, good to speak with you. I'll be attending your event this evening. And a moderator took my question about the bipartisanship taking place in Washington. I guess I'd like to ask another question. How do you see Washington, if in fact they'll be able to move from the small government talk that some people are talking, and yet the big government walk that we seem to be walking with all of the programs and things? I mean, they're diametrically opposed, and yet somehow we've got to find a way through them.
You feel like a lot of people have been calling for a smaller government, but in your view, you've seen a big government.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people want small government until it affects them, until there's a natural disaster or a hurricane or something like that, or a drought or a need for some kind of program, and then they want the government there, but seemingly don't want to pay for it, or don't want other people to be paying for it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, that has been I think a phenomenon in Washington that has been there for a long, long time, and it's one that when I've traveled in this part of the country, and I'd be curious to know what you think. You know, I've talked to people about farm subsidies, and I've been to places where, you know, someone, you know, at a county fair, I remember was talking to me. I think this was, where was this? This was in Wisconsin, I think. And I, you know, someone was just talking for a few minutes, and I had the microphone running about how awful government is. He wants the federal government to be smaller. And, you know, I said, you know, what about the Department of Agriculture? And do you get farm subsidies? He said, absolutely. And, you know, my question was, is that a role that the government should be playing? Is that an important one in your life? And he made the argument that it's absolutely essential for his farm and his way of life. And so it's, those are the voices that I kind of listen to drill down into the question you're asking. But I'm not sure. You know, I certainly, as a journalist, I don't have the answer, but it's an interesting conundrum.
Because I read an article recently that talked about the corn farmers with the increase in some of the crop prices are doing quite well, and the government subsidies means very little to them. But you have farmers down south in peanuts or rice or maybe dairy farmers in Wisconsin that are in a much different economic circumstance, and these subsidies mean a great deal to them. So, I mean, it's even at the farm level, there's polarization and fracturing of what government means to the people. So it concerns me because it doesn't seem like there's a willingness to work together, share the burden, and compromise and move forward for the good of the country as a whole.
Well, I think, you know, one of the arguments that that a lot of Republicans made when it came to the debate over the sequestration was that you know, this would be a good thing for the country to for people to sort out, you know, exactly what they truly need and what they truly don't. And that, you know, it's just one argument in the debate, but that was certainly one that was made by a lot of Republicans who supported the sequestration. So it's one interesting thing we're seeing play out right now.
Jim, thanks.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you tonight.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you too. Come say hi, Jim.
Jim, thanks for the call, Jim. You know, I think you do a lot of traveling, have done a lot of traveling, as you've alluded to, around the country and talk to people. And I think some of us sometimes get the impression that the folks in Washington don't do enough of that they just don't get it. They don't get what the rest of us are thinking.
You know, lawmakers say that they go home and they listen to their constituents. And I wonder, and I'm not saying one way or the other, but I think it would be really interesting to really drill down into how often that's the case or not. I know my colleague, Don Gagne, you know, a lot of people were asking, you know, a lot of the Tea Party members in this recent debate keep saying, you know, why do they have the positions that they do? And they would say, well, we're listening to our constituents. And Don went to a district in Georgia. And sure enough, you know, exactly what the people on the ground told him were what their member of Congress was saying in Washington. And so sometimes it's a matter of, you know, not being in the actual district where someone is from. And you know, you can judge them. But if you went actually to where they're from, you would kind of get a mouthful and understand where they're coming from. There's an argument that Washington sort of lives in this bubble.
Sure. And particularly the way the district lines are being drawn or have been drawn as a result of the most recent census, they're going home to friendly territory, most of them, and they're going to echo what those folks are saying.
And no reason to change their views. If this is what their constituents want, and if changing their views would get some of these members a challenge in a primary, you sort of get the feeling, you know, politically, why should they send any different message?
Exactly. Let's take another call. Jerry joins us from O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I first want to say I'm a former journalism student, that the show you're on probably brings more in-depth knowledge to the listening audience, more than any other medium, and tackles some really in-depth, like last week, talking about what really makes a viable community. And my question is essentially, I don't think I've lived in a period of time when we have had such an uncritical media, and I know that everyone has to play to their particular audience, but I don't think, you know, if you give equal time to the opposite side, I think that, you know, you have so many people that don't believe in, you know, the Earth is older than 10,000 years, or that, you know, there's no such thing as climate change, and when you have facts that are balanced at the very least like 90-10 percentage-wise, the solution seems to be, well, we have to give the other side equal time, and regardless of the validity of the argument. And, you know, recent statements, we hear Ted Cruz say that millions of Americans are going to, their lives are being damaged or destroyed by Obamacare, and yet no one asks a follow-up question. Could you please give an example of how these millions of people are seeing the damage to their lives, and no one seems to ask the follow-up questions.
I don't think there is any easy answer to what you're talking about, Jerry. And this is something that, you know, in politics, that, you know, I think about the question of when to have a third candidate on the stage in a presidential debate. You know, who decides when, you know, a point of view that is not necessarily that popular, but is important to hear from. And so I think it's a struggle. And I'll just tell you, I go back and I think about the buildup to the war in Iraq. I did a story. I spoke to people in Pennsylvania, and the link between believing that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 and supporting the Iraq war was unbelievable. And I would say to the people I was interviewing, I would say, well, you know, there are some questions about whether Dick Cheney and George W. Bush have made the argument that, you know, solidly with evidence that Saddam Hussein had a role in 9/11. You know, some say that there's no link there whatsoever. So I did that story. We in the White House press corps got bashed left and right for not being critical, you know, enough. of, you know, that administration in that buildup. And what I tell people when they ask me that, you know, what I think of that criticism, I say, at some point as a journalist, it is not my job to go out and bang people over the head with a baseball bat and say over and over and over again, are you not getting it? You know, the evidence might not be there. At some point, it's, you know, it's my job to step away. I've done the story. People can read it. They can sort of take it in. And so that's the other side of the argument. But I, your question absolutely makes sense. And I think it's something that I think journalists struggle every day. But I would say, if, you know, my default is going to be to listen to as many points of view and all points of view in a debate as humanly possible.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Al, who is calling from Ellisville. Go ahead, Al. You're on the air with David Green.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is, how much of this vitriol and I say downright hatred is ascribed to the president just being the first African-American president? I'm no closed-minded liberal, but, geez, it seems that he can't do anything right.
I don't know the answer to your question. You know, it's certainly in Washington, listening to lawmakers and in the recent debates. I haven't detected any sort of racism involved. It hasn't seemed to me that it's about the fact that Barack Obama is the first black president. But you know, I'd be interested if you think that that's playing a role and where you feel like you're seeing that.
We hear – I'm not sure Al is still with us. We hear that a lot in this program, people trying to make that connection. And I know you spent a lot of time in 2008 covering racial issues in this country as a result of that campaign. But we do hear it a lot here, that people are concerned that this is behind it. Mitch McConnell kind of comments, you know, I want to make sure he's a one-term president, that has a racial overtone to it somehow.
And what do people say is they feel like – where are they hearing that? Like what sort of strikes them?
Just that the animosity, that people really seem to dislike, even hate President Obama.
That's where the hatred might come from, even if people are not
exactly
acknowledging it.
That seems to be precisely what we're hearing.
We did do a lot of in-depth reporting and in the campaign, and I spoke to people who, you know, in some places who admitted being former racists themselves. I mean, they would use terms like that to me, and some of them were voting for Barack Obama and said they were, you know, quote unquote, recovering racists, which were some of the most interesting interviews I've done. And it makes me hearing you tell me that people are raising that issue right now makes me want to get back out there and listen to more people at a time like this.
Well, the campaign for 2016 has already started.
There you get your hands.
It would seem to me. So you'll probably have an opportunity, David Green, to be out there.
You got it.
Thank you so much for being with us. I know you've got other things to do today.
Real pleasure.
I'll let you go. I'll remind folks once again that NPR presents David Green and Robert Smith in Family Matters, Your Financial Lifetime, tonight at 6:30 and 409, that is, at DeBerg Hall over at St. Louis University. One final note here. We have an email from Kevin who says he wants you to rub that cardinal that you've been carrying around with you today.
It's not going to make me very popular in Pittsburgh.
Well, it will here. Have him rub it and wish it luck, because we're going to need
okay,
it.
Okay, I'm doing
I think Kevin is a little bit of a pessimist
I'm
about
doing
it
right now. There you go.
That's David Green. Again, thank you so much, David.
Have a great
visit in St. Louis.
Thanks.
A progress report on plans to renovate the Arch Grounds. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.